Hello, and welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, March 4th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. We'll start with the weather. Today it'll be turning cloudy and mild with a high of 55 degrees. Tonight it'll be partly cloudy with a low of 27 degrees. And tomorrow will be cloudy and mild with a high of 57 degrees. And now we turn to today's local and state news stories. Sioux City Council to vote on $1.8 million pedestrian bridge contract. Big Sioux pedestrian bridge to link Sioux City and Dakota Dunes. Dolly A. Butts reports from Sioux City. The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to award a $1.8 million contract to a Lincoln, Nebraska construction company for the second phase of the Big Sioux pedestrian bridge crossing project. The bridge will be located just north of Interstate 29 and built over the Big Sioux River, linking Sioux City and Dakota Dunes trail systems. According to city documents, the project includes the construction of a pre-engineered steel truss pedestrian bridge, grading, storm sewer, retaining wall, construction, and PCC paving for a 10-foot-wide trail. The project, which was bid on February 13th, received three bids. All of those bids came in above the city engineer's estimate of $1,591,021. K2 Real Estate Development, LLC of Lincoln, submitted the low bid of $1.875 million. The city of Sioux City has still not received the Army Corps of Engineers permit for the project, but expects to get it by the time construction will begin, according to the documents. Construction of the trails are allowed to be completed without the permit, but the bridge work can't be completed without a permit, the document stated. The city is managing the joint project, which is being funded through a combination of sources, including the Dakota Dunes CID, Sioux City General Obligation Bonds, private contributions, and Destination Iowa grant funding. The project has a total construction budget of $2.6 million. In 2022, the Siouxland Trails Network was awarded a $7 million tourism grant from State of Iowa to expedite the development of a network of recreational trails in Metro Sioux City. The Big Sioux Pedestrian Bridge was one of five projects listed on the city's Destination Iowa grant funding application. Since the pedestrian bridge received Destination Iowa grant funds, the project must be under contract by September 30th, as stipulated by the grant. Failure to comply with this stipulation would result in the forfeiture of the entire $7 million grant, according to city documents. The council is also expected to vote on First Amendment to a 28E agreement between the city and Dakota Dunes Community Improvement District, CID, for the project. The amendment adds language which allows the agreement to be terminated by a written agreement approved by both parties. Sioux City Parks and Recreation Director Matt Salvatore described the amendment as a technicality required by the Iowa Secretary of State. After the agreement was approved locally, he said it went to the state for approval. The state came back with the addition of language to allow either side to get out of the agreement. The 28E agreement sets forth the responsibilities of the city and the Dakota Dunes CID, as well as each party's share of the construction expenses. Under the agreement, which both parties entered into on June 5, 2023, the City of Sioux City is responsible for the cost of the bridge's design and inspection. The city also supervises the project's bidding and construction administration and has the authority to sell the naming rights of the bridge and trail. Dakota Dunes participates financially in the bridge's construction in an amount not to exceed $140,000. Sioux City insures the bridge, and Dakota Dunes is responsible for reimbursing half of the premium and half of any deductible for any claims that arise. Each jurisdiction will own the portion of the bridge that exists within its corporate boundary. Sioux City is responsible for all bridge maintenance, while Dakota Dunes agrees to pay $1,000 annually toward bridge maintenance. Dakota Dunes also pays 25% of the total of any mutually agreed capital improvement projects. Fish stories. At the Holy Cross famous fish fry, come for the cod, stick around for the fellowship. Earl Horlick reports from Sioux City. Each week, Al Metz orders 25 gallons of green beans, 40 gallons of mac and cheese, and, get this, more than 750 six-ounce pieces of fillet of cod. Is he going to feed an army? No, Metz is simply the go-to person at the Holy Cross famous fish dinner, held from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. every Friday during Lent at the St. Michael Catholic Parish Center at 2223 Indian Hills Drive. With more than 40 years of experience as kitchen manager for Hy-Vee, Metz is clearly the right person for the job. I'm the guy who is nervously attending to every minor detail, the Bloomington, Minnesota native explained, with one eye on the clock. If I do my job well, my crew can do their job easily while feeding upwards of 700 people over the course of the next 2 hours. Indeed, Metz and his kitchen helpers have their system down pat, with prep beginning shortly after noon each Friday. By 3 p.m., each piece is hand-breaded with a special seasoning before it is given a deep-fried dunk. Bags and bags of au gratin potatoes are soaked in a bath of butter and milk in pans prior to a trip into the oven. Containers of gooey mac and cheese are then heated up in oversized pots on burners inside of the Paris Center's professional quality kitchen. In an adjacent area, church women slice up a seemingly never-ending assortment of cakes, pies, brownies, and bars that have been handmade by Holy Cross parishioners. We have a set menu of fish, au gratin potatoes, mac and cheese, coleslaw, a salad bar, and a roll with butter, Met said. However, we never know what will end up on our dessert table. Decadent as it was last Friday, with delicious desserts like pecan pie and raisin cream pie ready for the taking, everything on our dessert table comes from a family recipe and is offered with love, Met said. The same might be said of the salad station, which also contains a few uniquely Midwestern offerings. We have some ladies who will always bring their recipe for glorified rice, Metz said, describing the dish as rice served with pineapple, whipped cream, and sometimes maraschino cherries. You have to be of a certain age to know what glorified rice is, but once you taste it, you'll love it. The real star of the Holy Cross famous fish dinner is the incredibly meaty and moist cod that comes sizzling from the fryer. While 6 ounces of cod comes with every order, it can easily serve 2 people, Metz said. We are very generous when it comes to fish. That's to be expected, given the long-standing tradition for Catholics to abstain from meat on Ash Wednesday, as well as each Friday during Lent. It isn't unusual for followers to choose a Friday vegan or vegetarian diet. Otherwise, fish is often used as a substitute for meat-based meals. Given the popularity of Fish Fridays, locally owned restaurants and national chains have even jumped on the bandwagon with seasonal seafood menus. This causes Metz to shake his head in disbelief. Catholic churches have had fish fries for years, he said. Why go to a chain restaurant when you get the real deal here? The real deal at St. Michael's includes being served handmade food on actual plates. For on-the-go families, takeout orders are an option. Takeout orders were a holdover from the COVID years, Metz said. We've extended it because it proved to be so popular. Beyond the food, fish fries are a time for people to socialize. Nothing brings people together better than good food and good conversation, Metz said. We have plenty of both every Friday night. Even better, you don't have to be Catholic to grab a plate at the Holy Cross fish dinner. We serve Lutheran, Methodist, you name it, Met said. Nobody is ever turned away here. In fact, everyone is dazzled and well-fed by this phenomenal fish fry feed. There is something really special about a fish fry during the season of Lent, Metz explained. You come for the food and then stick around for the fellowship. Anything else? Well, you can't forget about the desserts, he added. Our parishioners' desserts are just as memorable as the fish. And now we turn to national and world news stories. Leaders present 6 bills. New legislation sets full-year spending levels for some agencies. Kevin Freaking reports from Washington. Congressional leaders on Sunday came out with a package of six bills setting full-year spending levels for some federal agencies, a step forward in a long-overdue funding process beset by sharp political divisions between the two parties, as well as infighting among House Republicans. The release of the text of legislation over the weekend was designed to meet the House's rule to give lawmakers at least 72 hours to study a bill before voting. And it's a promising sign that lawmakers will avoid a partial shutdown that would kick in at 12:01 a.m. Saturday for those agencies covered under the bill, such as Veterans Affairs, Agriculture, Transportation, Justice, and others. Congressional leaders hope to complete the votes on the package this week and continue negotiations on the remaining six annual spending bills to pass them before a March 22nd deadline. The price tag for the package out Sunday comes to about $460 billion, representing less than 30% of the discretionary fund spending Congress looks to approve for this year. The package still being negotiated includes defense spending. House Speaker Mike Johnson highlighted some key policy and spending wins for conservatives, even as many of his GOP colleagues consider the changes inadequate. Some House Republicans had hoped the prospect of a shutdown could leverage more concessions from Democrats. Overall, this year's spending bills would keep non-defense spending relatively flat with last year's bill, despite the rise in inflation and some $70 billion less than what President Joe Biden originally sought. House Republicans secured key conservative policy victories, rejected left-wing proposals, and imposed sharp cuts to agencies and programs critical to President Biden's agenda, Johnson said in a prepared statement. Earlier this year, Johnson and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced an agreement on the top-line spending levels for this year's discretionary spending, which comes to more than $1.6 trillion. But that agreement didn't address potential policy mandates placed within the bills. That's where negotiations have focused in recent weeks. Democrats staved off most of the policy riders that House Republicans sought to include. For example, they beat back an effort to reverse the FDA's decision that allows the abortion pill mifepristone to be sold in retail pharmacies instead of only in hospitals, clinics, and medical offices. Democrats also said the bill would fully fund a nutrition program for low-income women, infants, and children, known as WIC, providing about $7 billion for the program, a $1 billion increase from the previous year. House Republicans were able to achieve some policy wins, however. One provision, for example, will prevent the sale of oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to China. Thousands remember Bloody Sunday. Harris honors activists, warns of modern-day attacks on freedom. Kim Chandler reports from Selma, Alabama. Vice President Kamala Harris told thousands gathered for the 59th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday attacks on civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama, that fundamental freedoms, including the right to vote, are under attack in America even today. Harris joined those gathered at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where voting rights activists were beaten back by law enforcement officers in 1965. The vice president praised the marchers' bravery for engaging in a defining moment of the civil rights struggle. "Today we know our fight for freedom is not over, because in this moment we are witnessing a full-on attack on hard-fought, hard-won freedoms, starting with the freedom that unlocks all others, the freedom to vote," Harris said. She criticized attempts to restrict voting, including limits on absentee voting and early voting, and said the nation is again at a crossroads. What kind of country do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a country of freedom, liberty, and justice, or a country of injustice, hate, and fear? Harris asked, encouraging people to answer with their vote. She paid tribute to the civil rights marchers who walked across the bridge in 1965, knowing they would face certain violence in seeking a future that was more equal, more just, and more free. Decisions by the Supreme Court and lower courts since 2006 have weakened the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was passed in the wake of the police attacks in Selma. The demonstrators were beaten by officers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge on March 7, 1965, as they tried to march across Alabama to support voting rights. Harris drew parallels between those who worked to stifle the civil rights movement and extremists, she said, are trying to enact restrictions on voting, education, and reproductive care. She said other fundamental freedoms under attack include the freedom of a woman to make decisions about her own body, a reference to state abortion bans. She also stressed the Biden administration's support for a six-week ceasefire in Gaza to get the hostages out and a significant amount of aid in. Under a blazing blue sky, Harris then led the crowd across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in the march that concludes the annual commemoration. Thousands followed, sometimes singing hymns and anthems of the civil rights movement, including "Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Round." Earlier Sunday, Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke at a Selma church service marking the anniversary of the attack by Alabama law officers on civil rights demonstrators. He said recent court decisions and certain state legislation have endangered voting rights in much of the nation. Since those court decisions, there has been a dramatic increase in legislative measures that make it harder for millions of eligible voters to vote and to elect representatives of their choice, Garland told worshipers at Selma's Tabernacle Baptist Church, the site of one of the first mass meetings of the voting rights movement. Israeli Prime Minister angered by rivals' U.S. visit. Centrist Gantz's trip signals cracks in country's leadership. From Tel Aviv, Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rebuked a top cabinet minister arriving in Washington on Sunday for talks with U.S. officials, according to an Israeli official, signaling widening cracks within the country's leadership nearly 5 months into its war with Hamas. The trip by Benny Gantz, a centrist political rival who joined Netanyahu's wartime cabinet following Hamas's October 7th attack, comes as friction between the U.S. and Netanyahu is rising over how to alleviate the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza and what the post-war plan for the enclave should look like. An official from Netanyahu's far-right Likud party said Gantz's trip was planned without authorization from the Israeli leader. The official said Netanyahu had a tough talk with Gantz and told him the country has just one prime minister. Gantz is scheduled to meet Monday with U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, and on Tuesday with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, according to his National Unity Party. A second Israeli official speaking on condition of anonymity said Gantz's visit is intended to strengthen ties with the U.S. and bolster support for Israel's war. In Egypt, talks were underway to broker a ceasefire before the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins next week. Israel did not send a delegation because the government is reportedly waiting to learn which hostages are alive and how many Palestinian prisoners Hamas seeks to exchange for each. California girds for more heavy snow. From Truckee, California. A major highway was closed and ski resorts were shut down Sunday as the effects of a powerful blizzard continued to cause problems across the Sierra Nevada, and forecasters warned that more heavy snow was on the way for Northern California. Sections of Interstate 80 to the west and north of Lake Tahoe, were made impassable by blowing snow piling up in lanes with no estimate for reopening, the California Highway Patrol said. The CHP office in South Lake Tahoe warned motorists that tire chains for improved traction are required on routes through the mountains where more than 7 feet of snow fell over the weekend. The online warning Sunday was accompanied by a photo of a big rig without chains stuck in whiteout conditions on a local road. "Trying to bypass chain control, no, no, no," the agency said on X, formerly Twitter, dangerous and not smart. Zelensky urges allies to boost military aid. From Kyiv, Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky urged Western allies to boost Ukraine's air defenses after a Russian drone strike destroyed an apartment block in the southern port city of Odessa and killed at least 11 people. Officials on Sunday said the bodies of a boy and a young woman clutching an infant were pulled from Saturday's rubble. The mother tried to cover the 8-month-old child with her own body. She tried to save them. They were found in a firm embrace, said a Telegram post published on the Interior Ministry's official channel. On Saturday, Ukrainian authorities said another baby was among those killed after falling debris from an Iranian-made drone hit the building. Later that day, Zelensky said a second child, age 2, had also died. Pakistan. Lawmakers in Pakistan's National Assembly on Sunday elected Shehbaz Sharif as the country's new prime minister for the second time, as allies of imprisoned former Premier Imran Khan in parliament shouted in protest, alleging rigging in last month's election. Haiti. Hundreds of inmates fled Haiti's main prison after armed gangs stormed the facility in an overnight explosion of violence that engulfed much of the capital. At least 5 people were dead Sunday. Amish death. Sean C. Cranston, 52, of Corry, Pennsylvania, was arrested Saturday and charged with the slaying of Rebecca A. Byler, 23, a pregnant Amish woman whose body was found last week. Texas wildfires. Firefighters battled against strong winds in their efforts to contain the unprecedented wildfires Sunday in the Texas Panhandle, where several wildfires have burned over 1.2 million acres. Doctors' rally. Thousands of senior doctors rallied in the South Korean capital of Seoul on Sunday to express their support for junior doctors who have been on strike for nearly 2 weeks over a government plan to sharply increase the number of medical school admissions. And finally, the Norway King. An airplane carrying Norway's King Harald V departed Malaysia on Sunday, a day after he was implanted with a pacemaker. Europe's oldest reigning monarch was hospitalized for an infection during a private vacation on the northern resort island of Langkawi, the royal house said Tuesday. And now we turn to sports stories. In college basketball, Clark stands alone. Iowa star breaks Maravich's NCAA DI scoring record. Eric Olson reports. Caitlin Clark stood alone at the free throw line on Sunday and made the foul shots that left her standing alone atop the all-time NCAA Division I scoring chart. The flash and pizzazz of her game have made her the biggest name in all of college basketball, yet it was 2 free throws after a technical foul that pushed Clark past the late Pete Maravich's 54-year-old record in No. 6 Iowa's 93-83 win over No. 2 Ohio State. Clark entered the game in Iowa City, needing 18 points to pass Maravich's total of 3,667, amassed in just 83 games over 3 seasons at LSU, from 1967 to 70. She finished with 35 to run her total to 3,685 in 130 games. Maravich's mark fell 4 days after Clark broke Lynette Woodard's major college women's record with 33 points against Minnesota on Wednesday. Best known for her long three-pointers, Clark was called on to go to the foul line after Cody McMahon was assessed a technical for giving her a little push during a dead ball with less than a second to go in the first half. Clark had no immediate reaction after the second shot went through, as if it hadn't sunk in yet. Asked in a television interview at halftime if she was aware of the record when she stepped to the line, Clark said, "Not really. When they announced it and everybody screamed, that's when I knew." Then the celebration was on, with Clark jumping around and pumping her fists in the air. "She has gotten off to a slow start," she had gotten off to a slow start Sunday. Her first shot was a three-pointer that bounced off the rim. She missed a layup, and from deep on the right wing before making a three from the left side for her first basket. After starting 2 for 7, she made 3 of her next 4 shots, including 3 straight threes, each deeper than the previous. Woodard was among the attendees at Carver Hawkeye Arena to help Clark celebrate Senior Day. Also on hand were basketball great Maya Moore, who was Clark's favorite player, and Baseball Hall of Fame pitcher Nolan Ryan. "It's a great time for women's basketball," Woodard said in a television interview. "Caitlin is leading the way. As she was chipping away, I said records are made to be broken. Also, they're made to be honored. Because of her, my records are being honored. She's gone beyond that now. She's gone beyond Pete. I passed her the baton to go ahead and burst through that ceiling, and I'm so happy for her." On Thursday, Clark announced she would enter the 2024 WNBA draft and skip the 5th year of eligibility available to athletes who competed during the COVID-19 pandemic. She is projected to be the number 1 overall pick by the Indiana Fever, and the WNBA already is seeing a rise in ticket sales. Logitix, which researches prices on ticket resale platforms, reported an average sale price of $598 for a ticket to Sunday's game purchased since February 1st. Kieran Nanjapa, who was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and now lives in Denver, said he paid more than $200 for his ticket. "She's a truly once-in-a-lifetime player," he said. "I've been watching Iowa basketball for 40 years, and I've never seen a player like her, men's or women's. I'll just say this, I paid more to see her today than I paid to see Michael Jordan 3 times at the end of his career, and I never thought I'd say that." Clark is all but assured of 1 or 2 more appearances at the arena in Iowa City. Iowa is projected to be a number 2 seed for the NCAA tournament, meaning it would be at home for the first 2 rounds. Pearl Moore of Francis Marion owns the overall women's record with 4,061 points from 1975 to 79 at the small college level in the AIAW. Moore had 177 points at Anderson Junior College before enrolling at Francis Marion. Clark is 376 points behind Moore, and she has only 2 to 9 more games left in an Iowa uniform, depending on how far the Hawkeyes advance in the Big Ten and NCAA tournaments. The fall of Maravich's record is subject to scrutiny. Maravich's all-time scoring mark is one of the more remarkable in sports history. There was no shot clock or three-point line in his era. The three-point line was adopted in 1986. Maravich averaged 44.2 points per game. He scored more than 60 in a game 4 times, topping out at 69 against Alabama on February 7, 1970. Clark averages 28.3 points for her career. Her career best output was 49 points against Michigan on February 15, when she passed Kelsey Plum as the NCAA Women's Division I career scoring leader. Clark has 55 games with at least 30 points, the most of any player in men's or women's college basketball over the last 25 years. She has 6 triple-doubles this season and 17 in her career. "What Caitlin's done has been amazing. She's a fantastic player, great for the women's game and basketball in general," Maravich's eldest son, Jason, told the Associated Press last week. And now we'll start NBA stories. Celtics win by third largest margin in franchise history, from Boston. Jaylen Brown scored 29 points, Jason Tatum had 27 on his 26th birthday, and the Boston Celtics posted their third largest winning margin in franchise history, drubbing the Golden State Warriors 140-88 on Sunday. Peyton Pritchard added 19 points for the NBA-leading Celtics, who set a league record with their third win this season by 50 points or more, and extended their season-best winning streak to 11 games. Boston led by a franchise record 44 points at halftime and pushed it to 51 early in the third quarter before coach Joe Mazzulla went to his reserves. Stephen Curry didn't play the second half and finished with a season-low 4 points for Golden State, his fewest since he had 3 points in 16 minutes on March 16, 2022 at Boston, a game he departed with a foot injury. Curry was 2 of 13 from the field Sunday and missed all 9 of his 3-point attempts, including consecutive air balls in the opening quarter. Lester Quinones led Golden State with 17 points. Once again, you are listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, March 4th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Continuing NBA news, Clippers 89, Timberwolves 88. Kawhi Leonard had 32 points, and Los Angeles beat host Minnesota in a physical and defensive game between two of the top 4 teams in the Western Conference. 76ers 120, Mavericks 116. Tobias Harris scored 28 points, and Philadelphia won at Dallas. Luka Doncic had 38 points, 11 rebounds, and 10 assists for his third straight triple-double, but he also added 17 turnovers for the sloppy Mavericks. Raptors 111, Hornets 106. Emmanuel Quickley scored 22 points and matched his season high with 11 assists. RJ Barrett had 23 points, and Toronto beat Charlotte at home for the 7th straight time. Spurs 117, Pacers 105. Victor Wembanyama had 31 points and 12 rebounds to lead San Antonio past visiting Indiana. He added 6 blocks, 6 assists, and a steal while going 3 for 4 on 3-pointers. Knicks 107, Cavaliers 98. Dante DiVincenzo scored 28 points, Josh Hart had 19 rebounds, 13 points and 10 assists, and New York earned a gritty win at Cleveland, despite an injury to Jalen Brunson. Thunder 118, Suns 110. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander had 36 points, 10 rebounds, and 9 assists, and Oklahoma City held off host Phoenix after leading by 24 points during the third quarter. Magic 113, Pistons 91. Paolo Banchero scored 29 points for a second straight game, and Orlando completed a 4-game season sweep of visiting Detroit. In other NBA news, Brunson bruises left knee, exits early. From Cleveland, Knicks All-Star guard Jalen Brunson had to be helped off the floor Sunday with a left knee bruise in the first minute against the Cavaliers. Brunson, who averages 27.2 points per game, was hurt while attempting a jump shot over Cleveland's Isaac Okoro. Brunson came off a screen near the foul line and raised up without any contact. Following the game, Knicks coach Tom Thibodeau said x-rays on Brunson's knee were negative, a report that brought relief to New York fans. "It's a knee contusion," said a relaxed Thibodeau. "He bumped knees, that's what happened. He got the x-rays, was examined by the doctor, everything was negative. We'll see where he is tomorrow." On the play, the 27-year-old Brunson shot an air ball and his legs split awkwardly as he came back down. He staggered toward the 3-point line before falling to the floor while grabbing his left leg in obvious pain. Brunson sat on the floor as play continued, and he briefly got up before limping to the sideline and dropping back down. A replay showed that early in New York's first possession, Brunson banged knees with Knicks center Isaiah Hartenstein as he moved past his teammate, setting a screen for him. Brunson did not return to the bench and was not seen after the game. Brunson has been keeping the Knicks together during a rough stretch of injuries. They've been without Julius Randle, with a shoulder injury, Mitchell Robinson, ankle, and OG Anunoby, elbow, who all made the trip and are getting close to returning. And finally, the NBA stat of the day, 7-0. Denver is 4-0 this season against Stephen Curry and 3-0 against LeBron James. The Nuggets are the first team in NBA history to sweep 3-plus games against two different multi-team former MVPs in the same regular season. Now turning to the NHL, Danault helps Kings thump Devils. From Los Angeles, Philip Danault had a hat trick. Kevin Fiala added a goal and two assists, and the Los Angeles Kings easily defeated the New Jersey Devils 5-1 on Sunday. Alex Laferriere also scored. Cam Talbot made 30 saves, and the Kings have won 8 of 12 under interim coach Jim Hiller. "Obviously, we're playing way better now," Fiala said. "Had a 2 or 3 month slump or whatever, and we have been playing better after the All-Star break. We are playing for each other, we love each other, and you can really feel it right now." Nico Daws was replaced in the second period after giving up 4 goals on 13 shots for the Devils, who have lost 5 of 7. Timo Meier scored, and Akira Schmid made 9 saves in relief. "I don't think it's about effort, it's more between the ears," New Jersey forward Eric Haula said. "We keep kind of shooting ourselves in the foot. We keep making similar mistakes, and at this time of the year, it's going to hurt you." In other games, Coyotes 5, Capitals 2. Washington lost to visiting Arizona in a potentially decisive defeat for its playoff hopes. The Capitals are 6 points out with less than a week to go before the trade deadline. Charlie Lindgren allowed 4 goals on 27 shots in a third consecutive start. The Coyotes have won 2 in a row since their 14-game losing streak ended. Wild 4, Sharks 3. Kirill Kaprizov posted his second hat trick in less than 2 weeks by scoring the go-ahead goal with 3 minutes and 59 seconds left to lift Minnesota over visiting San Jose. Canucks 2, Ducks 1. Connor Garland scored the go-ahead goal early in the second period, and Vancouver beat host Anaheim. Jets 5, Sabres 2. Morgan Barron scored the tie-breaking goal on a partial breakaway with 6 minutes and 5 seconds remaining, and Winnipeg defeated host Buffalo for its 9th victory in 11 games. Oilers 6, Penguins 1. Zach Hyman scored twice, Calvin Picard made 23 saves, and Edmonton routed visiting Pittsburgh. In other NHL news, Okposo Gergensen's trying to save Sabres. From Buffalo, New York. If this in fact becomes Kyle Okposo's and Zemgus Gergensen's final week in Buffalo, the longest serving players on the Sabres roster provided one more reminder of their understated leadership and desire to turn the franchise into a winner. Off the ice, neither was willing to discuss whether they're open to being dealt with the trade deadline approaching on Friday. Their preference is to not create a distraction for a young team attempting to make one last gasp to climb back into the playoff race. On the ice, Okposo and Gergensen's spurred a 7-2 victory over Vegas on Saturday night by scoring critical goals to help settle a team in jeopardy of sagging after blowing a 2-0 lead. Gergensen's, an assistant captain, scored the go-ahead goal by driving to the net late in the second period. Okposo, the team's captain, followed by providing Buffalo a 2-goal cushion after converting a rebound for a goal 2 minutes and 20 seconds into the third period. On a team brimming with young talent, leave it to the old guard to produce in the clutch. "Well, yeah, you know what you're going to get from us. We're going to play hard and did that," Okposo said about himself and Gergensen's. "It was just fun to have a game like that." Rangers. Veteran goalie Jonathan Quick agreed to a contract extension with New York worth $1.275 million for the 2024-25 season. The 38-year-old is 13-5-2 with a .916 save percentage this season for the Rangers. Capitals. Longtime center Evgeny Kuznetsov cleared waivers on Sunday, and Washington immediately assigned the 31-year-old to Hershey of the AHL. and the NHL stat of the day. Kyle Palmieri of the New York Islanders notched his first natural hat trick in over 11 years on Saturday, scoring all three goals in the first period against visiting Boston. His last natural hat trick came on February 27, 2013. In NASCAR news at the Pennzoil 400, Larson wins again at Las Vegas. Hendrick Motorsports wins second race, Chevrolet undefeated. Jenna Fryer reports from Las Vegas. There's a tradition at Hendrick Motorsports to ring the winning bell throughout the North Carolina shop after every NASCAR victory. As motivation to have the best year of his career, Kyle Larson's team decided to bring a bell on the road to avoid having to wait to return to Charlotte to celebrate every achievement he plans for this season. The bell got its first ring Sunday when Larson won his second consecutive race at Las Vegas Motor Speedway to keep Chevrolet undefeated and give Rick Hendrick his second victory in the first three NASCAR Cup Series races of the season. Hendrick Motorsports is celebrating its 40th anniversary this season and opened the year with William Byron winning the Daytona 500. That bell will travel with us every week and we'll be ringing it loud and proud, Larson said. Larson won for the third time in his career at Las Vegas, where in 2021 he got his first win driving for Hendrick following a nearly year-long suspension in 2020. Larson also won in the number 5 Chevy at Las Vegas last October in the playoffs. Larson held off Tyler Reddick for his 24th career Cup victory. In a Toyota for 23XI Racing, Reddick chased Larson for the final several laps but could never find enough room to make a move for the pass. Larson's margin of victory was 0.441 seconds over Reddick. I knew Tyler was going to be the guy to beat from the first stage. He was really fast there, Larson said. Cool to get a win here at Vegas again. Back-to-back, swept all the stages again. Can't ask for more than that. Reddick was extremely frustrated after finishing second and believed Larson, as the leader, controlled the race because of the rules of NASCAR's new car. Kyle did a really good job there, taking away pretty much every option I had there to close the gap, Reddick said. Second sucks, that is for sure. You have to run up front all day long, and when asked about what we need to do to get better, that's the very thing, and we didn't do it. We were pretty evenly matched, so I don't know if there was anything that I really could have done to get around him. He would have had to make a big mistake, or had some traffic kind of knock his wind around. It's a solid effort for our team. That's how we need to run, but I don't like running second. And in one NFL story, award-winning NFL reporter Chris Mortensen dies at 72. Joe Reedy reports, Chris Mortensen, the award-winning journalist who covered the NFL for close to four decades, including 32 as a senior analyst at ESPN, died Sunday morning. He was 72. ESPN confirmed Mortensen's death on Sunday. There was no immediate word on the cause or place of death. Mort was widely respected as an industry pioneer and universally beloved as a supportive, hard-working teammate, ESPN president Jimmy Pitaro said in a statement. He covered the NFL with extraordinary skill and passion and was at the top of his field for decades. He will truly be missed by colleagues and fans, and our hearts and thoughts are with his loved ones. Mortensen announced in 2016 that he had been diagnosed with throat cancer. Even while undergoing treatment, he was the first to confirm the retirement of Hall of Fame quarterback Peyton Manning. We lost a true legend, Manning said in a social media post. Mort was the best in the business, and I cherished our friendship. I trusted him with my announcement to sign with the Broncos and with the news of my retirement. I will miss him dearly, and my thoughts and prayers are with Mickey and his family. Rest in peace, Mort. Mortensen announced his retirement after the NFL draft last year so that he could focus on my health, family, and faith. He is survived by his wife, Mickey, and son, Alex. Now let's get some advice from Ask Amy. by Amy Dickinson. For brothers, the path is paved with eggshells. Dear Amy, my brother and I have always had a tenuous relationship. Our father was abusive, but we are both in midlife and have led fairly successful and stable lives. I often have to walk on eggshells when speaking with my brother, because he always seems to read what I'm saying or doing as an attack. Last New Year's Eve, I was attending a get-together with friends, and he called to video chat. I sent a quick text saying that I was with friends and that we'd talk later. He texted saying that he was disappointed because he had told his kids they could talk with their uncle, me, and that I seemed to have chosen my friends over my nephews. He did add that maybe he should have given me a heads up, but he felt the need to share how I disappointed not only him but my nephews. I did not know how to respond and waited for 3 weeks to text him back, and then only to wish him a good day on the anniversary of our late mother's birthday. It has been 3 weeks and he has not responded. We're not in touch very often, but I feel like I'm being punished. My question is, what should I do now? Should I keep trying to reach out? I'm sure that whatever I do will be wrong. Signed, Stuck. Dear Stuck, the perpetual dance of disappointment between you and your brother is a result of growing up with an abusive parent. Your relationship is unstable, in part because you were both trained from childhood to remain on high alert. Children in abusive households can never really relax and allow themselves to make mistakes, to have their mistakes forgiven, and to just be natural. Yes, the ground is paved with eggshells. This tension and instability defines your relationship now. But there is an advantage to always feeling like you're doing the wrong thing. This liberates you from having to second guess your every decision, because no matter what you do or say, it's going to seem wrong. So do it anyway. You don't need to respond to your brother to keep in touch with him. Just text him. Say, "Hey, I was thinking about you today, and I'm wondering how you and the kids are doing. I'd really like to set up a FaceTime session with them. Any chance we can do this sometime soon? I'm suggesting that you just clomp your way across those eggshells and do your best to simply be yourself. Your unflappable efforts might inspire your brother to finally relax and do the same." Dear Amy, sensitive stepmother wrote that her stepdaughter's mentally unstable mother, who had no contact for several years, had reached out to the stepmom privately, asking for her to arrange contact with the girls. Thank you for responding with a hard no to this. My mother, similar story, found ways to draw other people into her drama in order to get to us. We were afraid of her and really needed the adults around us to protect us, not open the door. Signed, Gratefully Grown. Dear Grown, thank you for affirming my instincts about this. In more news on advice, relationship advice from Erica Etten. Exclusive versus official. What do they mean? I've received a lot of questions in the past 6 months, more than ever before, asking if there's a difference between being exclusive with someone and the relationship being official. People are also asking, how long should I wait after being exclusive before being official? The question usually comes from someone who is seeing someone they like, it's usually a woman asking, and she's told by her potential partner, "I'm comfortable being exclusive, as in only dating each other, but I'm not ready to make it official yet, not ready for titles or labels yet." With all the ambiguity around exclusivity and official labels, it's no wonder people are scratching their heads and asking, "What's the deal?" Trust me, you're not alone. My quick answer to the question, how long should I wait after being exclusive before being official, is zero time. What do I mean by that? I know there seems to be this trend now where people are exclusive, yet there are no labels like boyfriend or partner. And then eventually, maybe, they are official. But I personally think they should be one and the same. If you feel comfortable being exclusive with someone, I also want you to feel comfortable saying that you're in a relationship with that person. If that means it takes longer for you to become exclusive, then so be it. There are many reasons to become exclusive with someone. The hoped-for reason is that you both feel comfortable not exploring things any longer with anyone else. But I worry that if someone is dangling exclusivity without the title that the other person wants, it's because they simply don't have the time to see other people, or they think it'll calm down the person who's really interested in a relationship. As in most of the advice I give, communication is key. If you're feeling unsure or curious about where you stand, don't be afraid to speak up. I've seen too many instances where one person thinks that exclusivity means deleting the dating apps and the other does not. In the conversation, talk through both of your expectations. And if someone says, "I'm okay being exclusive, but I'm not ready to put labels on us yet," then it's up to you to decide if you're okay with this yourself. You don't need to just go along with it if you think something, exclusivity, is better than nothing. You need to honor your own wants and needs too. You can even say, "How should I introduce you to people when we go out?" If they hem and haw and avoid eye contact, that's information worth knowing. Remember that your happiness and fulfillment in a relationship are non-negotiable. Don't settle for ambiguity or uncertainty if it doesn't align with your desires and expectations. Your feelings are valid, and you deserve clarity and respect in your romantic connections. So trust your instincts and advocate for yourself. If something doesn't feel right, or if you're craving more definition in your relationship, don't hesitate to address it with your partner. Healthy relationships are built on mutual understanding, compromise, and open communication. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, March 4th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. A total eclipse of the sun is a special occurrence. The last time that the sun and moon lined up perfectly for a total eclipse traversing the U.S. was in 2017. Another one is due on April 8, 2024, crossing the country from Texas to Maine. While millions of Americans gaze at the sky in wonder, scientists will be hard at work. Because a total eclipse, by blocking the sun itself, gives us the rare chance to study its corona, the fiery, heated atmosphere around it, from within the path of totality. And there are still many mysteries to unravel. For instance, the surface temperature of the sun is 5,500 degrees centigrade, yet the corona is far hotter, up to 20 million degrees. How could this be possible? One study will fly a NASA high-altitude research plane along the path of the eclipse, using spectrometers and high-resolution infrared cameras to record the temperature, structure, and chemical composition of the corona, and of coronal mass ejections or solar flares, to increase our understanding of the solar winds that reach Earth and affect our weather. And NASA needs your help. Visit the NASA website and download the SunSketcher 2024 app. They're hoping thousands of Americans will take photos of the total eclipse with their phones, which NASA will process and add to its study. With that simple action, you'll become a citizen scientist. I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from EarthX, bringing people together to build a sustainable future at earthx.org. And you can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.